Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Humans like starting new things much more than taking care of older things. This is true on both an institutional and individual level. It's more exciting to build a new road than to maintain an old one, more exciting to lose weight than to keep it off. There's plenty of short-term pleasure and intrinsic motivation when it comes to pursuing something novel, but the effort to keep up unsexy maintenance on what we've already got takes real intent. My guest today says we've lost that intent and need to revive it. His name is Lee Vinsel. He's a professor of science, technology, and society, the co-founder of The Maintainers, which is a research network dedicated to the study of maintenance, repair, upkeep, and ordinary work, and the co-author of The Innovation Delusion, How Our Obsession with the New Has Disrupted the Work That Matters Most. Lee and I begin our conversation with how our cultural focus on innovation has come at the expense of attention paid to maintenance and repair, and yet how talking more about innovation hasn't really led to greater progress. We then get into the way the necessity of maintenance, repair, and caretaking has been neglected in business and government, creating a situation where we keep building new things without investing in the upkeep of our current infrastructure. From there, we turn to the way our all-too-common neglect of maintenance applies not only to big institutions, but also our personal lives, as in the areas of homeownership and health. We discuss how there's less incentive these days to repair things in our disposable society where everything is cheap and stuff is harder to fix, even if we want to fix that stuff. We end our conversation with how we can revive a maintenance mindset in our culture and individual lives. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/maintenance. Lee Vinsel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so you've co-authored a book dedicated to the idea that we need to revive our sense of the importance of maintenance and repair. But you spend the first half of the book arguing that one of the reasons that maintenance has been neglected is that we started spending all of our time thinking about innovation, even though all that emphasis on innovation, ironically, doesn't actually result in more real innovation. We'll talk about what this modern overemphasis on innovation looks like here in a minute. But to start, when did you first realize that maybe our focus on innovation isn't all it's cracked up to be?
It really came from like a frustration with the way people were talking about innovation. You know, I work in universities and university administrators just talk about innovation, innovation, innovation all the time. And you also hear it in the business world, especially in the kind of Silicon Valley tech sector. So for us, it started with just a frustration with how empty the word had become. And then only later, my buddy made a joke. So Walter Isaacson's book, it was called The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. That book came out. And my buddy Andy, who I wrote the book with, said we should write a counter volume, which would be called The Maintainers, How Bureaucrats, Standards Engineers, and Introverts Create Technologies That Kind of Work Most of the Time. And we played with that online, like on Twitter and blog posts and stuff, and it just kind of took on a life of its own. And then it was through kind of exploring that that dichotomy between the way people are talking about innovation and, you know, maintenance and repair that we started to see that, you know, that the way we talk about innovation has these dark sides. So I wouldn't say it was like immediate insight. It would really kind of came over time from thinking about these issues.
Well, let's talk about this idea about the way we talk about innovation at universities and businesses, even in the government. In the book, you make this point. It's important to distinguish between actual innovation and innovation speak. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so actual innovation is the process of introducing new things or new processes, new business models, things like that. And one of the reasons we want to make, you know, this distinction is because we think innovation is really important. You know, human life has really changed over the last 150 or 200 years with, you know, the rise of all these technologies like electricity and computing, and, you know, we can go on and on. But innovation speak, our use of the word innovation didn't really start until after World War II. Not only that, so we want to say like this way we've talk about innovation has a history, and if you look at like some people argue that actual innovation slowed down since about 1970 or so, and yet we've been talking about innovation more and more, and so it's not clear that talking about innovation is actually getting us innovation, and so that's one reason why this distinction is really important is to be clear that, you know, the kind of talk and hype is different from the thing, and just to be very clear about that.
Well, in some of the stuff you hear today about innovation speak, it's like, we're going to innovate or we're going to disrupt. That's the kind of stuff you hear and you're like, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, disruption is one of these things that started off with a very narrow, precise meeting in the early 1990s. And then it just becomes, you know, this hot buzzword that people throw around that has no meaning, basically, you know. And there's lots of other ones like agile and lean, you know, all kinds of innovation, social innovation, social entrepreneurship. There's just this huge, like, bag of buzzwords. Design thinking, of course.
Design thinking. Yeah, that's another one. Well, I think you make this interesting point, sort of the history of this innovation speak, the way we talk about innovation. Before World War II, people didn't use the word innovate when they talked about technology. They used the word progress. And when you hear progress, you think, okay, things get better, like our life gets better. And you and your co-author make this case that, yeah, like before World War II, like the technological advancements that we made, a lot of them, like they brought progress. Like they brought us out of poverty and increased health, et cetera.
Well, I mean, so you could, there's a tool that your listeners can play around with called Google Ngram. It's N-G-R-A-M. And it allows you to track word use over time. It's just fun to throw in there like peanut butter and jelly or whatever and see when people started talking about that. But if you throw in progress in there, you can see that our use of the word progress actually starts going down in the late 1960s. You know, I mean, that's the time of like Nixon and the Vietnam War, and there's all these environmental problems and the economy is like in the garbage. And people started kind of lost faith in progress, moral progress, that our society was getting better and better. And innovation almost becomes a substitution word. It's not saying, you know, it's not saying that society is going to progress necessarily. It's like technology is going to get better and somehow that's going to save us.
Right. So there's been a decoupling between like actual innovation and human progress. Before, like, you know, you get electricity, that changes people's lives, or indoor plumbing or antibiotics. That's a game changer. But now it's like, okay, you have a new app on your smartphone. Does it really make that much of a difference?
Totally. Yeah. And you see all these firms like Uber and Peloton and WeWork. And there's so many firms right now that are struggling to be profitable, right? And they're like often app-driven things. And they're just not that big of a benefit to human life. You know, they smooth out some things, they make some things more convenient. But it's not electricity. It's not the automobile. It's not, you know, modern chemicals or whatever, right? It's not that big.
But what happened? Like, why was there a decoupling? Like, right around the 1960s of like technological innovation and like what we call progress, like our lives getting better. What do you think happened?
So it's there's huge debates in economics and history about this issue right now. My take is that, you know, one way to put it is that we kind of plucked all the low-hanging fruit in technology. And some of the biggest changes in technology were, and this is like the economist Robert Gordon argues, they came between 1870 and 1970. So you're talking about the car, electricity, the airlines, chemicals, electronics industries, early computing, all these things, right? And then, you know, after 1970 or 1980, those things are not improving that rapidly. So when we talk about innovation, a lot of times we're talking about cell phones and the internet, right? And I would never say that, right now you and I are talking over Skype and doing this interview remotely. And, you know, in higher ed today, because of COVID, we're running our classes over Zoom or whatever. I would never say that those things have not had some effect, but it's a very narrow band of human life. And then, you know, your toilet hasn't improved that much over the last 50 years or whatever, right? Like, there's a lot of areas of human life where things are pretty set and mature. And I think that's the issue, is that there's a lot of parts of our life that just haven't been changing that rapidly.
Yeah, I think I've heard like this thought experiment. People ask like a hypothetical, like, would you rather give up like your iPad and your internet connected devices or indoor plumbing, electricity, and antibiotics?
Concrete.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you're like, yeah, I would be fine without all this, like pretty much all the tech inventions from 2000 on. I'd be okay if I didn't have it.
I mean, like Slack is nice to do business work over with. And even though, you know, we can also talk about how a lot of these things are also distractions and actually interrupt our work too, right? So they're not always wins, but it's not that big of an improvement over email or the kinds of things we had in the 90s.
And another point you guys make is that, well, so we want innovation, like, because we have this idea that new is better, but not necessarily. And so as a result, there's been these like industries that have built up. They're like innovation industries where they sell you the idea of innovation. Like, walk us through some of these businesses that have grown up to sell us the idea of innovation.
Yeah, so we highlight three in the book. I'll start with Clayton Christensen. He was a Harvard Business School professor. He died a year or two ago now. And he's the guy who came up with the idea of disruptive innovation, or at least the term. He was actually borrowed the idea from an earlier economist. And you know, the idea of disruption is that some new innovation is going to like blow an existing industry or technology out of the water. Like, now we have Netflix, and you know, the only remaining Blockbuster you can like rent from Airbnb and sleep in it or something like that, right? And so Christensen had a consulting firm called InnoSight, where I guess they like put innovation goggles on you, that you could hire in to either teach you to be a disruptor or teach you to avoid being disrupted, I guess. And he made a lot of money off of that consulting group. And then, you know, we also talk about Richard Florida, who's the guy who created the notion of creative class. He's made a lot of money off of basically cities hiring him and his firm to come in and make their, you know, their places more appealing to hipsters and creative types who were supposed to create economic growth. And, you know, then there's like the design thinking IDEO Stanford D School folks who promise to make you more innovative but don't really have any evidence for it. And I should say that part of the issue is Christensen's ideas actually don't hold up to like, you know, social scientific analysis. This notion of disruption just doesn't hold any water. But part of what we're trying to argue is that because we want innovation and because it makes profit for companies and because it makes growth for nations and governments, you know, it creates this space for people to like claim they're experts that could give you some solution that could come and make you more innovative, or, you know, make us all, you know, create more innovations. And you know, that's so it creates a consulting space, you know, and they have like incentives to not really be honest with us about their ideas and how effective they are.
And you know, a lot of this, innovations, like, well, that's interesting. You talk about the point that like innovation actually happens, but when it does happen, it usually happens like slowly and often accidentally, like serendipitously. You can't like plan for innovation. It's hard to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like enough of a, you know, a progressive professor, like, you know, stereotypical in that way, where I want the government to spend money on like scientific research, because I think that leads downstream to actual innovations that benefit our life. But, you know, like, this is a place where I actually think there's something to like conservative and libertarian arguments where you can't really steer this stuff, right? It's like you can't plan it in a way. And I think that's part of the problem with these innovation consultants is they want to give you a recipe for how to produce innovation, and it just doesn't work that way.
So all this time while we've been spending money on and time and energy on thinking about how to be more innovative, and like those innovations that we come up with, I mean, they're not that great. Like, at best we get email, Slack, which can help things a little. I mean, email has helped a lot. Slack, not so much. Then you have things like the Juicero, which you talk about.
Right. I just said there's new Juiceros. There's one now for tortillas, like homemade tortillas. And there's like a cocktail Juicero. So instead of making your own cocktails, which I think is a manly thing to do, you're supposed to use this, you know, use this gadget to just have it do it for you.
Right. Well, for those who don't know, the Juicero, it's a smart juicing thing where you have to buy these pouches with juice in, basically kind of pulpy juice, and then the Juicero squeezes it because you push a button in your smartphone. And I guess people realize you could just squeeze the stuff out with your hands out of the pouch.
Yeah, you could just cut the thing open with scissors and squeeze it out, and the machine wasn't doing that much. So
yeah, that innovation speaks can get you innovations like that, which aren't very useful. So all this time we've been thinking about how to be innovative. You make the case we've been neglecting maintenance. What do you think is going on there? Like, why? Let's talk about maintenance in the first place. You make the case in the book that maintenance is necessary, but it's often neglected. And this isn't new. This has been a problem for most of human history. Like, how far back do we know that people have had problems with maintenance?
Oh, all the way back. You know, we talked to the historian Pam Long, she's a historian of like the Middle Ages and the ancient world. And she says that in Rome in like the 14th or 15th century, like it's just absolutely awful. There was no maintenance going on. And so, you know, there's lots of other examples of like failing sewer systems in ancient Rome and stuff. So maintenance has always been a problem, as you say.
And how has it become more of a problem in the 20th and 21st centuries?
There's a number of areas of life we can talk about. I mean, I think the kind of high theme here is that there's a lot of incentives these days for short-term thinking. So in the corporate sector, for instance, there's a lot of emphasis put on the quarterly report and for producing short-term growth and, you know, to boost stock prices and such. Well, that is going to lead you to put a lot of emphasis on, you know, creating the new thing that's going to get that extra boost and distract you from keeping going, you know, the things that are already there. And we see the same thing in government. So our federal infrastructure programs are aimed to get money to localities to build roads and such. But then there's no federal money for maintenance. And what the localities are doing is signing on to maintain those things forever, right? Or until they want to put the road to bed. And they don't have the tax money to do that. So they have the short-term incentive to take the federal money to build the thing. That's awesome. And everyone can stand in front of it and take a pretty picture and, you know, cut a ribbon or whatever. But then, you know, they're not considering the downroad costs of it.
Well, so another interesting point you made in the book was like at the 19th century, like the railroad tycoons, they actually kind of figured out that maintenance was an important part of their business operation and they had to invest a lot and they actually built up an infrastructure for maintenance and they actually like maintainers, people who'd maintain that, like that was a not a high status, but it was well paid and it was well regarded. But then like slowly into the 20th century, like maintenance or the maintenance professions kind of were seen as dead end work. What do you think happened there, like from the 19th century to the 20th century, where maintenance or being involved in maintenance work was seen as, you know, like just not something to aspire to?
Yeah, well, part of it is that we look at like the status that is associated with work as part of our argument. And something that happens is as technologies age, they go down in terms of social status. So in the 19th century, it was high status to be a mechanic or an electrician. Those were both things that you would do as a aspiring young person who wanted to move up in the world. Well, obviously, that's not how we talk about those trades now. That's not, I'm not saying, you know, like socially, we judge those as like the trades, right? And they're for people, you know, in quotation marks who aren't, you know, college material or whatever. This is not how I think about it. That's how people talk about it. And so as technologies age, the status of working on them tends to go down. And we see that actually happening with coding and computer work right now. So they're becoming more blue collar like, and eventually you might not even need to go to college to do them. So I think that this is one dynamic, and answer to your question, is as the things get older, the status of working on them declines.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code manliness to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code manliness. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. Let's go back to this idea of where we're having problems with maintenance. You mentioned roads, and I thought this was really interesting because in the U.S., we're always talking about the poor state of our infrastructure. And it's always sort of like a platform for both whatever politician, whatever side of the spectrum they're on. Roads are bad, bridges are crumbling. And I really didn't understand like what's going on there. And you, as you said before, like what happened is like the federal government subsidizes federal highways, but then passes it on to the states and the local municipalities to maintain the roads. I mean, I guess the problem is like when these local governments decide to take on these new roads or new bridges, like why don't they think about the maintenance costs? Like why don't they think about, oh, we're going to get this free bridge basically, but they don't think about, and then we're going to have to pay for it 30, 40 years down the line.
I think because they're not required to, you know, I mean, it's basically free money they're getting from the federal government or very, very low interest loans. And they're not required to show that, you know, that they can handle the cost down the line. So the incentives are like directly aligned for them taking the money and then dealing with it later. And they won't even be in office when or around when it becomes a problem, like 20 or 30 years down the road. So I think it's about incentives ultimately.
And then the other problem too is that, you know, maybe they accepted the money when things were great, but then their like tax base has been decimated because they've lost an industry. So I'm thinking like Rust Belt type places where they had all the car industry and they thought, yeah, maybe in 50 years we'll be able to maintain it. But now that the industry's gone, they don't have the tax base to support the maintenance of the road anymore.
Yeah, I mean, this guy Chuck Marone at Strong Towns, who's really a good person to follow on these issues, I mean, he's shown and argues that this issue of like taking on too much, you know, too much infrastructural debt and not being able to maintain it is a problem in like normal, healthy communities. But obviously, there's lots of parts of our country that have depopulated over the last 30 or 40 years. So that becomes an even bigger problem, right? You just don't even have the tax base to keep going. Then you face really tough questions about like how to handle repair water systems for a municipality when there's no money, right? Those are huge questions for our society.
Well, are there places in the world that you found where they've been able to crack this maintenance nut? Like, were they able to keep their infrastructure? It's stable. It's good. It's in good working order.
You know, it's funny. We do look at a couple places in the book. So first of all, you can look like at Japanese high-speed rail systems. They have amazing maintenance. They've never had a deadly accident. And, you know, like their average annual delay is like by a minute. The average delay over time is a minute. And you tell that to people on like the Northeastern corridor, where, you know, they use the train to get from New York to Washington, D.C. or whatever, they're going to cry. And then we also look at like water maintenance, water management systems in the Netherlands that are pretty amazing, and they do a good job maintaining. This is how they deal with ocean water. But, you know, since the book came out, there's been a series of articles about the canal systems in Amsterdam and how they're collapsing. So it's just like, I think you can find some cultures that are better at it in general, but there's always exceptions. You know, apparently even the Dutch aren't good at maintaining some things.
Well, so one point you make in the book is that in order to solve these maintenance issues, like when stuff's falling apart, governments, even universities, businesses, the typical solution is, okay, we're going to grow our way out of it, right? We don't have the money now. Maybe if you throw more money at it right now, get bigger, that'll solve the problem. But then you guys make this case that, well, growth, yeah, it can solve the problem, but then it just perpetuates the problems you already had before. Like, how so? What's going on there?
Well, I think there's two sides of it. The first side is that, in a sense, our infrastructural problem comes from growth, right? Or the way we use federal money to build infrastructure is a post-World War II thing. And during that time, we've grown out the suburbs in our country at an amazing rate. And so we've used federal, it's almost like a bubble of sorts, you know? We've used federal money to build up all this infrastructure. Now we're stuck with it. So growth becomes a liability down the road. And I also think growth is just not sustainable as a strategy. It's not sustainable environmentally for lots of production. But, you know, you look at universities today, they want to deal with everything in terms of growth. Well, every university in the nation's trying to deal with their problems via growth. And you just think about the numbers of students and how there's actually going to be declining numbers of college students over the next decade. Not everyone's going to grow. You know, it's just, it's not realistic. So I think both how growth becomes a liability and is not like a realistic long-term strategy, those are the two sides that come to mind right now.
Right. So as you get bigger, it's just more stuff to maintain.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's part of the history of, you know, we can think of like modern life is that, you know, we had the railroads, then we had, you know, the telephone system, and we had the electricity system, and then the highways and the road systems, water systems, all these things that make modern life, as we've built them up over the last 150 years, they become debts and liabilities that we're accountable for. So, I mean, that's an argument for saying we really need to, if we're going to build more, we need to think about how we're going to pay for it before we do so.
Yeah, and I've heard this phrase, like this term, I think it's from that guy, Parkinson, who came with Parkinson's Law, like time fills the space available or work fills the time available. He also had like some other things like basically if an organization gets above 1,000, like most of the work at that point just goes to maintaining the organization.
That sounds right.
And not actually doing anything new. And yeah. You can see that. Yeah. You can see that at universities. I mean, you look at all the number of deans and administrators and they're not, it's just, I mean, that's a problem. And there's like not much teaching going. I have a friend who's a professor and it's a constant, I mean, he carps about it. I get it.
Oh man, it's so true. And you talk about like, you know, how we saddle students with like all this debt in our country. And I think there's a pretty strong argument to be made that the reason we've been raising tuition is because we've added this enormous layer of administration, you know?
So we've been talking about the problems institutions have with maintenance. So governments, businesses, et cetera. But we also have these same problems of maintenance on the personal level. Like where in our personal lives have you seen people having problems with maintenance?
Boy, I mean, I think at home, if you're a homeowner or renter, but especially if you're a homeowner, I think you know the realities of maintenance and how it's so easy to push it off. So one of the things I did for the book is I actually bought a house here in Blacksburg, Virginia, when we were working on the book. And I talked to a home inspector, you know, a guy who does inspections for sales. And he was just telling me all kinds of wild stories of like, you know, he climbs on people's roofs to find if they're sound or not. And he actually fell partway through one like a month or two before we had talked. And he said, you know, he said that the scariest thing he sees is when he goes and looks at people's decks on the back of their houses. And he says so often he just has nightmares that people are going to have like a family party or something. They're just going to collapse under too many people. So, I mean, I think that's, you know, we can also talk about, you know, what renters experience, but homeownership is a very clear example of where we see this kind of deferred maintenance problem.
Right. Owning a car, same thing.
Totally. Yeah.
Totally. But even like our health, right? There's a lot of like stuff we should be doing. We know we should be doing like sort of preventative maintenance. You go get the yearly checkup to make sure you catch things early. But people are just like, yeah, especially men. They're like, yeah, I don't have
right.
I can just put that off.
Put the beer gut on, right?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I don't have to do that. But that, then again, you defer the cost. And then like when you're 60 or 70, you have like diabetes and all these other health issues that you could have nipped it in the bud earlier.
Yeah. Like heart disease is a great example of that, right? But yeah, I mean, that's really where it touches people on the, it's funny because we write about, you know, we write about the nation, we write about organizations, we write about all these different things, but it's often like the bodily maintenance and thinking about like short-term rewards of like another cookie or another beer or whatever it is versus exercising and all the, you know, the long-term thinking, that's really where it hits people. It's like, oh yeah. Like this is an individual level problem as well as a society level one, right?
And then also on the personal level, I mean, you guys talk about there was we had it at a time in our culture, this idea of like, you know, use it up, wear it out, make do without. Like sort of you could fix stuff, right? If something wore out, you could, you know, your grandma would darn her socks, grandpa would fix the tractor. But now because stuff is so cheap, if something breaks, you're just like, well, just go get a new one, buy one on Amazon, I'll be here the next day. I don't have to worry about fixing it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this is another part of the technological revolution of the last couple hundred years. I have a lecture called Modernity Equals Cheap Crap that I give in most of my classes. And it's, you know, I start the lecture with things just like falling out of people's closets or falling out of like their garages. About like half of American garages are still full of stuff that they can't be used to put cars in. And, you know, I mean, what this is about is the cheapness of things in our lives. We take that for granted and we don't really realize how amazing it is. But as a result, it is often cheaper for you to go buy a new toaster than it is to get your toaster fixed. And of course, this has big environmental ramifications, right? Because we're just like, we become a very disposable society.
Well, and the other problem too is that companies have started to make consumer goods that it's harder to repair. So like Apple, I think, is a prime example of that. It's like if you want to replace the battery, you can't do it yourself anymore. You have to like go somewhere and have them replace the battery for you.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of aware of this thing called the right to repair movement, which is fighting companies locking down repair before we wrote the book. But as we wrote the book, I really became a big proponent of it. And so I look up to people like Kyle Wines of iFixit, the repair site, or Nathan Proctor at US PIRG. These guys are really fighting to pass laws to make our stuff repairable again. But it's true. It's become a corporate strategy, but from, you know, it's John Deere and some automakers and Apple and a lot of other gadget makers have like really tried to make their things not repairable so that we have to rely on them.
Yeah, you go to them. And then, I mean, it also brings up, this kind of brings up ideas in law of like, what does it mean to own something? Like, do you really own the thing if you can't fix it, if it breaks down? Are you just leasing it?
I know. It gets weird. Like, are you licensing your phone from Apple? I think this really pushes, in the States, I think this, you know, this kind of upsets really deep, long-held traditions of autonomy and, you know, individualism and stuff that we've kind of feel cut off from our things and that we don't have the right to repair them. That doesn't fit for us, I think.
Well, there's the problem. We're not maintaining it. So I think part of the problem is humans are really bad at thinking about the future. Like we're short-term thinkers, don't think about the long-term. This happens on the micro level, and then you see it happen on the macro level. You think people will get smarter when you start thinking high level, but they actually get dumber. But then also just our culture has changed. Things have gotten cheaper. Things are harder to repair. So we've lost this ability or this idea of maintenance. So what can we do to get back the maintenance mindset? Like what do you guys propose at the Maintainers?
Yeah, so we try to boil it down in the book to a couple ideas. I mean, I think, first of all, for organizations, it really requires leadership and realizing that this stuff is important and valuing it up front. And then it requires a kind of cultural shift, right? We have to get better at this together, especially if we're talking at the organizational level. And then, you know, where we can, we also need to, like, you know, talk about innovation and maintenance, like actual innovation and maintenance. So in the book, we cover companies that are making digital apps and other software, mostly to better manage maintenance, whether it's through predictive analytics and AI or remote sensing and stuff. There's ways we can get better both in infrastructural maintenance and in organizations at maintaining things. So we don't have there's another genre of book like this where you end with a bullet list of like policies that you'd like to see put in place, whether in government or businesses. And we chose not to end that way. It's more of a inviting people to the realization that this is important and then, you know, talking and thinking together about how we can improve.
Yeah, speaking of ideas of like innovation helping maintenance, I know like in the oil fields, they're using drones to like check lines to make sure there aren't any leaks. And it's all AI stuff. So they can see like, oh, there's a leak, and then they can go and fix it.
Yeah, we have a buddy named Varun who works in basically predictive analytics around gas leaks in, you know, natural gas heating type pipes. And it's you know, it can use remote sensors and algorithms now to watch things at a distance. So there's a lot of improvements that can happen. At the same time, you know, I think we're skeptical that those improvements alone are going to save us. We're in such a hole right now when it comes to infrastructure in the States that it's not going to be like, innovation alone is not going to save us. We're going to have to kind of get real about where we're at.
It's a mindset, that you have to take on, right? Well, and another cultural shift that has to happen is we have to raise the status of maintenance work as well. Like instead of thinking as, okay, it's a dead-end job, that's where you go if you don't go to college. Actually, hey, these people are an important part of like keeping, like sort of like the Mike Rowe approach. These are the guys who make civilized life possible.
Yeah, and you know, you can live a pretty good middle-class life in the trades. You know, I think we've just really kind of shot ourselves in the foot by assuming that you have to go to college to have a good life. You know, that's the way a lot of people talk. It's not true. And I work in universities, right? Like it's in my interest to say, yes, come to school. But the trades are great. But I think that, like you're saying, we have to rework how we value these jobs and realize that these people are important and they're giving value to our lives in important ways.
And I think the big takeaway that I got this from personally from the book was whenever I buy something now, it's like, okay, not only think about the cost that I have to clunk over to get the thing, I got to think about what's the cost of maintaining this thing as well. And I usually don't do that, but now I've been thinking about that. And not just in terms of like monetary cost, but like bandwidth cost, like where am I going to put this? What happens when I have to get rid of it? I mean, it's going to be a pain in the butt to get rid of if you buy some big thing. I'm starting to think about that stuff now.
Well, that's great. Andy and I had these kind of realizations as we were working on the book too. And I think, you know, that's where you end up is like, you know, I'm looking... We have one of these, you know, what are the kind of dehumidifiers you plug into the wall right now in our basement. And I'm thinking about buying a built-in one because for a variety of reasons to put in the basement. But now, you know, I'm doing research on like, what are the maintenance costs? What am I getting myself into here, right? I would have never done that before we worked on this.
And also that causes you to like kind of shift away from the growth mindset and thinking, okay, more stuff is better. It's like, well, actually, sometimes more isn't good, right? Like,
right, yeah, more is more costly. And
like you make the example, like obesity, like getting fat, like at a certain point, like fat's good, but at a certain point it becomes costly.
Yep, that's a great way to think about it.
So yeah, just pare down, it makes maintenance a lot easier. So where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
The easiest place to go is themaintainers.org. And we have an email listserv. People can join there. It's not too many emails, and it's a fun group. And then they can also just reach out to me. I'm lee@themaintainers.org, or Andy's andy@themaintainers.org. I'm also on Twitter @STS_news.
Fantastic. Well, Lee Vinsel, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, man. This was fun.
My guest today was Lee Vinsel. He is the co-author of the book, The Innovation Delusion. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Find out more information about his work at the website, themaintainers.org. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/maintenance, where we find links to resources where we can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years about pretty much anything you think of. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you all your listening AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.